start this.
Even for myself, I mean, I'm going to try to do some recap of different things that you might or might not know. But as Matthew situated, I mean, we're in a financial crisis. You have, like, you know, unemployment is rising. You have, the you know, this healthcare issue right now in the United States and around the world, actually, with this flu pandemic spreading. So, you know, people, and we're used to that kind of, you know, we set up our table and we try to organize people politically at what we can do to actually get rid of these problems. And you get some people who are really, they really want to talk about their issues. They really, like, they have one thing in their mind that really bugs them, and that's what they want us to fix. Now, that's a problem of not just these, you know, person we see in the street. I mean, it's a problem in the culture that we're seeing. We have to kind of cure that, and we got to use our, you know, humor and creativity, to help people get out of these single issues, because that's really the fact that they have that kind of, you know, mental disease, because it's really what it is, and not be able to reflect themselves in the process of what's happening to the rest of humanity. You know, that's a problem that we've had in the past centuries. It was, you know, I guess inoculated. Not into people's blood, but it was brought in the way that people see the world. So I'm talking about empiricism, talking about infected. Yeah. But infecting people's mind into how they see the universe that they're living in, or that they wish they were living outside of. And that's what we call empiricism or positivism. Reductionism, you know, Cartesianism. That's what we're gonna try to, you know, kind of cure, like, to some extent tonight, as I can. But LaRouche has written these two papers. One on especially the the title is really clear on the tensor. It's the ontological meaning of the tensors, and another one, which is called economic science, in short, or economy for scientists, where it goes through in a lot of details, useful historical and scientific details, to understand these tensors. So I'm going to start with this, with a quote by Lin, just to kind of situate ourselves into what's the intention here. So maybe Petros, you want to read it?
It is the paradoxical juxtaposition of contrasted dimensions of sense experiences which defines the object of the human intellect as such, and which supplies the intellectual solution for the ostensibly paradoxical character of that real existence which casts those shadows called sense perceptions.
Well, there's only one kid on that picture.
But it looks like there's two.
Right? It looks like. But, you know, if you receive a rock on your head, you won't blame the rock, right? You'll try to find out.
Yeah, right.
Where it came from.
Right.
So that's it, you know, I mean, behind that you can kind of like see that there's something else. I mean, what Lin says is pretty clear, but it gets to, you know, an underlying, conception of how the universe works. That is that there is intention. And there's, you know, there's a motive. There's something that makes things happen in the universe. And so, well, you see on that picture, well, it's pretty clear who's making the shadow, right? So that's our problem with empiricism. You know, this question, there's a pretty clear example of what's going on with this health care reform in the United States. There's this example of that city on the border of Texas named McAllen, where basically if you just look at the stats, that's a city in the United States that uses the most public funds for you know, Medicare and Medicaid. So the conclusion that came to mind of President Obama and his team was that clearly these doctors were inefficient in providing care to patients because they cost a lot. They're the, you know, they're in the city that costs the most in terms of healthcare. So clearly there's something wrong with them. Well, I mean, you know. And the New York Times wrote an article on it, so that must be true. So, but behind the numbers, what are these data, you know, really showing? You know, you decide that you're going to take how much it costs, but you know what is the process that makes these numbers appear that way, in a sense? Or why is it that that city? Have you thought about what is the cause of the, you know, that city being so, you know, costly in terms of care for people? So if you look behind what's going on with the data, you see that that city, basically on the border, there's a lot of, you know, people crossing the border and not necessarily in good shape all the time, right? So necessitating a lot of care. The economy of the United States has been destroyed during the past 40 years. That has to be taken into account. And that city is really, really poor. Plus, Texas, overall. I mean, baby boomers who can't go, or, you know, elderly persons who can't go to Florida because it's too expensive during the winter, they go in Texas. Now, 80%, or about 80% of the costs of healthcare, you know, throughout the nation, is, you know, basically like in the 20 last years of your life, average. So, the elderly costs a lot of money. Okay, but the issue is that the one who are poor can't afford Florida. So you go to Texas. So it what it does is that since you already are under like the normal like access to beds for, you know, for people who are sick in the hospitals in McAllen, well, now what you get is that, you know, during maybe 3-4 months of the year, during the winter time, you have a overflow of elderly people who need care. They need to go to the hospital.
Yes, if they don't have enough money to go to Florida, that means that they probably don't have enough money.
Well, they're going to use Medicaid, right? The public, Medicare is the public services for retired and elderly people. So that's where the costs come from. So it's not that the doctors are giving too much care to people. So, but these things you can't understand. You can investigate. And that's what we're going to look at a bit. We're going to start a bit more with kind of like this idea in the physical space, space-time. And going back to why Lin says that this concept of tensors has to actually be brought in economics, because it's the only way, the only competent way of understanding how the economy works or should be working, and how to introduce more singularities in the economy, our discoveries, I should say. Okay, start with Kepler. Everybody's pretty much, you know, acquainted with Kepler, or a little bit. Can somebody read the quote?
The testimony of the ages confirms that the motions of the planet are orbicular. It is an immediate presumption of reason, reflected in experience, that their gyrations are perfect circles. For among figures, it is circles, and among bodies, the heavens, that are considered the most perfect. However, when experience seems to teach something different to those who pay careful attention, namely that the planets deviate from a simple circular path, it gives rise to a powerful sense of wonder, which at length drives men to look into causes.
Mm-hmm. So Kepler made a pretty big discovery. Discovered universal gravitation. And he discovered it uniquely because he looked into causes, like he says himself. So he was pretty self, you know, reflective or self-conscious of what he was trying to do. And at the time of Kepler, I mean, these discoveries, to a certain extent, you know, even though they weren't brought to us, you know, by time, what Kepler discovered, not necessarily gravitation per se, but this idea of the organization of our solar system, that had been investigated before Kepler, but lost in time to a certain extent. At the time of Kepler, you had these three, this model of, there were different models, but like, that was one common model for a long, long period of time, where the Earth was in the center of the universe, and basically everything was gravitating around the Earth, and you had the different elements, you know, air, fire. So
wait, air and fire and the elements have their own orbits?
Yeah. That's I think there was I found that they didn't explain it on the website, but I was just thinking that really resembles the Pythagorean, but not really understood. Anyway, you know, Kepler kinda goes at Aristotle for depicting the Pythagorean like it's crazy, but they actually understood what they had codified, what they were saying, because they were persecuted a lot at the time. But that's a quote from the Timaeus, which basically tells you that, well, I'll read it. It's now from for that living creature which is designed to embrace within itself all living creatures, the fitting shape will be that which comprises within itself all the shapes there are. Wherefore, he wrought it into a round in the shape of a sphere, equidistant in all directions, from the center to the extremities, which of all shapes is the most perfect and the most self-similar, since he deemed that the similar is infinitely fairer than the dissimilar. And on the outside round about, it was all made smooth with great exactness, and that for many reasons. So that's, you know, the maybe you have read or that the time is. It's like a kind of like a different dialogue. It's more like a monologue by Plato, reporting the words of time is. It's kind of trying to explain how the universe was constructed at the beginning, trying to build up, you know, how the planets are going around. And at that time, yeah, you had an understanding that, you know, there was a spherical shape which would be the best adapted for, or the best like archetype for the universe. Although not necessarily that they had the system, the solar system like that. But I won't go into details on that, but we can look at it later. At the time of Kepler, okay, so coming back to Kepler, but we'll go back to a certain extent to this concept of having a spherical or self-bounded universe a bit later with Riemann. But at the time of Kepler, these were the three basic like system which were used to try to map where the planets would be, where they would go around, where you could see Mars, or, you know, how the system was working. But they were deficient. They were mathematically very nice, but in terms of like accounting for you know, the motion, why that way, why not another way, or, you know, even like why putting Mars in Ptolemy's example here, yeah, Mars, which is on its orbit around a point which doesn't exist. It's going around a point which has no physical you know, existence to it, and that point is going around the Earth.
So it's like doing spirals?
Yeah. It represents what your senses are seeing in the sky. That's the thing.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really give you any idea. If you look at all these models, they're all describing the same thing. It's all the same representation. Now they also have, you know, mistakes in them. It's not perfect for a good reason. I mean, the orbits are not circles. But that's what Kepler discovered. I won't get you through like the whole book. We don't have time tonight, but also I don't think I would be in a possibility right now, since I have like all these tensors things in my head. Distract me. But they were wrong, because they were just trying to base themselves on their senses, what they were seeing, what their sense apparatus was telling them. They would just try to copy it down on a page and try to build a system that would be, you know, as precise in the observations as possible. But they never really asked the question why. You know, or is it the Earth in the center, or the Sun, or what is moving all these things? So that's the question that actually Kepler asked. He didn't necessarily ask first if the Earth was in the center, but he asked, well, who's moving it? What is making the system, you know, you can call it the solar system, but eventually, what is making it moving like that? And on what shape? Because the circle was clearly not adequate to represent that. So that's really a major breakthrough that we have to keep in mind, that Kepler made, that brings us, oh, to this quote, yeah, because he talks about it. As I say, he was pretty conscious about what was going on and how he thought about it and what was the process, how he made his discovery. And he wanted to share it with everybody. So he says, "For as the sun in its revolution about its own axis moves all the planets by the emanation which it sends out from itself, so also the mind, as the philosophers tell us, understanding itself and all that is in itself, stimulates the use of reason, and by spreading and unfolding its simplicity, causes all things to be understood. And so closely are the motions of the planets round the sun and the processes of reasoning linked and tied to each other, that if the earth, our home, did not measure out its annual circuit in the midst of the other spheres, changing place for place, position for position, human reasoning would never struggle to the absolutely true distances of the planets, and to the other things which depend on them, and would never establish astronomy." I think, in a sense, what you're seeing in this quote is like, it to me, it resembles a lot the first quote, also by Kepler, of this idea that everything is going around in circles. But there's these, you know, slight anomalies that you see occurring. And if they were not occurring, then, you know, there wouldn't be no question. It's just, yeah, that's how it is. You know, everything goes around us.
Sounds like he's saying, like, God put them there on purpose so people could be like, so people could stay think or something.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, it's like a puzzle. Because really, these, you know, the reason of these, like the epicycles in Ptolemy's example, the circle that goes around the point that doesn't exist around the sun, or around the earth, actually. You know, well, that's for a reason, but the reason you can't find by just looking at the model was just created by what people saw. The fact is that, you know, over a period of 2 years, Mars make a loop in the sky. Mm-hmm. That looks kind of crazy. You're like, well, if they go around, that's why does Mars do that? It's not a perfect circle then. Mm-hmm. Or maybe there's something defect in the circle. So it brought people to try to figure out how they could, you know, map it or what was going on. But only Kepler really discovered it. You know, but not that long ago. So now we're going to get into more of mind-boggling things, but following this idea by Kepler, you know, yet scientists like Gauss and Riemann, who also made major breakthroughs, they're normally, like I was trying to find out a bit more, you know, what is commonly known if you type them, you know, in Google and try to search what they did. And they're normally known as mathematician. And, you know, that's not wrong, but they did much more than just, you know, calculating numbers or figuring out formulas. And that's what is totally skipped in what I saw, anyway. I don't know how they teach it, but it's a lot of formulas, and it's really mind-boggling. I'm not going to get you through these formulas tonight because I just can't understand them. I mean, it's just a lot. I mean, it's something that we will work, you know, we're working towards. We have a team which is now really working on the tensor. But for now, I can't tell you much more on my part, like the mats of it, that's not what I want to look at tonight. Like, I want to look at what is generating, what has generated this idea of tensors, because the fact is that tensors is just a word to explain something which has existed, a concept which has existed even before it was called a tensor. So, and that's where Lin is in his paper actually refers the use of tensors, or the, you know, original thinkers who developed that kind of concept, going back to Kuza and Kepler, that they actually, that's how they saw and made discoveries, even though they didn't call it a tensor. But they already had that idea in mind, which enabled them to understand a process and not just one element, you know, not just one planet in the solar system, but the whole. So, let's do it. That's a 3-page quote. Get Albert, do you want to read it? It's by Riemann.
The concept of a manifold of remote dimensions subsists independently of our intuitions of space. Space, plane, and line are only the most intuitive examples of manifold of two or one dimensions. Yet without having the most minimal intuition, we will be able to develop an entire geometry. I want to explain this with an example. Suppose that I wanted to make an experiment or observation, and it were only important to me to establish one numerical value, say the degree of heat. In this case, all possible results could be represented by a continuous series of numerical values from positive infinity to negative infinity. But suppose that I want to determine two numerical values. Say, I want to make a determination of temperature and a determination of weight. Then the result would have to be conditioned by two magnitudes of x and y and y. Here I would only obtain the totality of cases if I were to give x and y all values between negative infinity and positive infinity, combining each value of x with each value of y. I will obtain a unique case so long as x, taken also with y, has a determined value.
So far, so good?
No.
Yeah, no?
I'll try to just
put it down so it's a bit easier to see. So, Stevie. So now, you started with heat. Now it says the degree of heat, determination of temperature and weight.
Okay.
Temperature and weight. It says x and y. And so, and he's going to give, for these, going to give the value of minus infinity to positive for both. Okay. So that's the sign for infinity. Whoops. Okay. And it goes on.
Wait, I'm thinking about it on a Cartesian grid.
Yeah, don't do that.
Don't do that?
No.
Really? I should be thinking about it as a symbol right now. So when I'm thinking about it, it's like heat. I've got it on like a one axis, like the x-axis, like infinity that way and infinity that way. And then y, I've got on y-axis. So like infinity, like that way and that way. So that I've got like a line.
Yeah,
which
right.
is sort of like diagonal and infinity in both directions, which touches all of the examples.
Uh-huh.
That's how I've got it in my head right now.
Okay. Well, it could be one representation, but
okay.
that's, yeah, that's the way we do it in school. Yeah,
yeah okay, so...
Right. But, I mean, for that, it kind of work. Now, the thing is, he's also introducing, you know, at the beginning,
he's talking about the different here, space, plane, and line. So basically, you know, I'll just take the example of the cube. You're talking about space. He's kind of giving like an easy example right now. You can get into much more complicated. But for now, not try necessarily to map it. Try to just understand like the interaction between the heat and the weight as an object of your mind, but not just like to try to map it on some kind of grid or plan.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but they're just affecting each other at every moment, right? That's basically
yeah,
the point.
Right.
One is
think of yourself as heating something, right? You're heating an object, or you know, and you're trying to figure out with your meter what's the equivalence. You know, try as doing an experiment instead of as just like putting data on paper.
Okay. So
do
I've
the experiment.
Like, I've got like a scale.
Yeah.
Heat in it that I'm weighing with an apple or whatever, like some thing, and I'm seeing
yeah.
the weight as it heats up. So
yeah. Do your own, you know, you can all, maybe you have the apple, and you can take something else.
Un commentaire, de toute façon, la température et le poids ne peuvent pas être définis. Un poids peut aller en bas de 0. La température est la plus basse, c'est moins 373 degrés Kelvin, 0 absolu.
Ouais.
Tu peux pas le mettre,
ouais,
tu peux mettre sur un graphique, une limite.
Ouais, ben, pour, dépendamment, mais là, lui, il dit, ben, peut-être, ouais, ben, on n'a pas encore trouvé nécessairement de matière qui. Mais lui, il fait juste comme, c'est open, tu sais. Votre limite, vous allez l'avoir à un moment donné, mais, genre, on va pas mettre de limite pour l'instant, on va juste voir comment ça se passe. Ouais. Est-ce que tu veux continuer Alba ou quelqu'un peut continuer?
Now that I can extract out of the totality of cases a complex of cases, I can, for example, establish the equation ax plus by plus c equals 0. And now put all those cases together where x and y satisfy this equation. I were able to call this complex of cases a parenthesis straight line parenthesis. From this definition of a straight line, I would be able to derive all those theorems about straight lines that occur in geometry. It is clear that one could proceed in this way without relying on the most minimal intuitions about space. By this manner of treatment of geometry or the theory of manifolds of three dimensions, all the axioms which are taken in the usual manner of treating spatial intuitions, as for example, that true any two points only, one straight line is possible. The first axiom of Euclid disappears, and only those which are valid for magnitudes in general, for example, that of the order of summands in arbitrary remain.
What is that word, summons?
Yeah, I searched it and
summons?
Summons.
Nah.
I didn't find it. I don't know if it's in the dictionary, but I think just before that everything was perfect, but I'm gonna have to figure it out too. But what do you think about what you just said? If you subtract the sum. He's saying, so if you put, you know, these, if you do your experiment and you kind of, you see the interaction between the heat and the weight of whatever object you use, then that, let's say, could call it a progression, you couldn't map, you know, in a certain way with the data. You couldn't map. And you could call that a straight line, you know, on even if on your graph. That's the thing with Euclid. Now we're all brainwashed with Euclid, so that's the problem that we have first. Is that he's saying that what Euclid says about having, you know, between two points only one line that can go from these two points, there's only one straight line. He says that doesn't apply. Because straight, what does it mean? Does it really mean flat? You know, a flat line? And that's a really important thing. Because what in the world is flat? Yeah, I can find some spot on that table, which are. You sure? Just touch it. It's not flat.
No. Old beer.
Gonna have to erase that from the thing. But really, like, think about it. I mean, what is flat? I mean, you could, it's like, you go from Montreal to Quebec, and there's no way you can go just directly to it, you know, in that idea, you know, just, unless you're Superman or something. But even that, you go, you know, if you take the plane, I think that would be the straightest way to go to Quebec, to take the plane. Because the highways, well, everybody knows the highways in Quebec are not straight. That's not the most flat thing in the world.
So we're saying here that whatever we start off with at like one point, if we assign, if the result is zero, then it could be like a curve of some sort between two points.
Yeah.
Change is always changing.
Let's say, like, for this example of the temperature, like you gave that formula.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, zero. Let's say that you started, you know, your fire. You did the experiment with your object. And we'll use that scale, but
make it bigger.
Oh yeah. So let's say you had your object with something, you know, like some weight. You're starting heating it, and gradually the until it just totally disappeared.
Yeah.
You just burned it, consumed itself. It doesn't exist anymore. So let's say that was the result of the experiment. So he says, well, that line
could be qualified as the straight line of that particular function.
Are you talking about when you talk about the two points?
Yeah.
You refer to the point that the initial, I guess, the initial state of the thing you were heating.
Yeah.
Up to the other point,
which is, I mean, you can decide wherever you want to take it. You can take it here, wherever you want. But you know, you try to figure out what's the link between the heat you put on the object and the weight of that object. You know, it could be water. So he says that can be defined as a straight line. And that's another conception of straight line that I'm sure he didn't have before he came in. But it continues. So, do you have a question, or there's just one last part to this quote? No? Okay. Attends-toi, Albert. Si tu veux continuer. C'est la dernière partie. Ouais.
Okay. One now finds easily how in the same way one can obtain a manifold of two dimensions independent of the existence of a plane. Also, how one can reach a magnitude of arbitrarily many dimensions. We only must make observations which, parentheses, concern the determination of many numerical magnitudes. Sentence completed by Weber. But it is also interesting to understand the possibility that this treatment of geometry would nevertheless be extremely unfruitful, since we will not find any new theorems, and that what is achieved easily and simply through representation of space is only turned into something complex and difficult. One has to, in general, opt to take the opposite way, and where one runs into the geometry of manifolds of more dimensions, as in the study of definite integrals in the theory of imaginary magnitudes, one uses the intuitions of space as an aid. It is good to know how through this one achieves a true overview about the object and
subject.
Only about the subject, and only through this way can the essential points be directly brought forward.
That was Greek to me. I hope Petros knows something else.
Well, it sounds to me like he's saying that the Cartesian system is insufficient when you're exploring things that lie outside of it.
Yeah, but not only like the Cartesian, but yeah, that's true. I mean, when you add, because that's the thing, we only think about, you know, objects, in the term of like physics, we look at objects, it's always like, oh, okay, so you have like three dimensions. So basically, if you have a plan of three dimensions, then you're fine. You can just look at what's going on, you know, map it there. But the idea of Riemann is not just to map something, an object, but it's to understand like the process of generation.
What's the cause?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is not in the mapping. It's not like on the graph. It's not there.
kind of like the example.
And therefore the graph, you know, it comes after. You know, it's like these two points. Like if you were to hold your point, your finger. So from this point, how many line can you make to Petros's finger?
One.
Right? How many line could you draw from
potential lines, like,
yeah,
just say infinity,
right?
You draw from the side down.
So, but given, you know, that definition that, or that idea of a straight line that Riemann gave, all these lines would be straight between our two fingers. One would be flat.
Yeah.
On a Cartesian, you know, system. But really, they would all be straight lines.
Well, they're straight because the link two points. But straight doesn't mean that it's flat.
Right. Mm-hmm. True.
So he's changing the definition of straight, then. Like the concept of,
well,
straight.
Well, it's because he's taking, yeah.
His world is different from the Euclidean world?
Yeah.
Okay. So you have to change your definition.
Yeah, because Riemann, I didn't put the quote, but some people will remember in the habilitation dissertation, it was a pretty famous quote at the beginning, and then also at the end, the very end of it, where Riemann just says, like, okay, for 1,000 years, now we've been going with Euclid, but that's just, it ain't working. You know, it doesn't work. It's not sufficient. It's actually blocking us from making discoveries. It's a system which is flat.
No, I was gonna say that what you just pointed out with the line is a lot like, or with the graph rather, is a lot like what you were saying about the different orbits,
mm-hmm,
that existed before Kepler.
Yeah.
It's like they start with an axiom that it has to be circles. So they map it out and they represent it on a graph or in a circular system, and it just that axiom they started with is like a wall that blocks them from seeing what's really happening.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why, you know, at the beginning he didn't tell you, like, okay, let's say you have a graph. No, he didn't say, okay, you have, you know, something you're heating and you measure the weight of it. That's what you start with. Otherwise, you don't have an experiment.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you can figure out how to map these things. But you don't need to map it, you know, on a Cartesian plane. You can map it on something else. And that goes into this question of, well, what is the shape of space?
Now you go.
Right? What is the shape of space? Are you living it in a flat world or flat universe? So Riemann is not necessarily there to give you the answer. He's not going to say, like, okay, this is our world, this is how you know, it looks to me. No, he's going to bring you tools to actually find out what's really going on. And so, what universe are you in? One discussion I had, like at the beginning, when Lynn began to talk about these tensors, it was in a Saturday discussion that he had with the national team in Leesburg, and talking about tensors and all that. So I asked Merv, who was in the basement for a while, now he's in Boston, but I asked him, or what do you think is a tensor? And, you know, what different things that we had worked on in the past years, you know, how does it work with Kepler, why does Lynn say it's, you know, Kepler used tensors, and, you know, what's going on? I don't get it. And so Merv brought me kind of like examples to try to give me like some idea, like to make me think about these things. But the tensor, I mean, I'll read maybe the definition of that kind of like, that's what Bruce in his paper, one of the pedagogical that he wrote on tensors, he writes, a tensor is a type of quantity in which the dynamically connected relations within and among multiply extended manifolds are expressed as a unified magnitude. I'll just reread it.
Yeah.
I had to reread it a lot. A tensor is a type of quantity in which the dynamically connected relations within and among multiply extended manifolds are expressed as a unified magnitude. So I'll just get to this example. I think it's gonna, even though I don't think it's a perfect example of what I just said, it might just give you a better representation in your mind to grasp what it is, the tensor. But the discussion with Merv went on, and he gave me that example. He said, well, you have, let's say you call it gravitation, okay, which is a principle acting in the universe. We'll call it, you know, gravitation. And so that's something which is acting universally, okay? And so depending of how, you know, what's your reference point, what, how you actually see it acting, you might represent it differently, okay? You might have a representation which kind of fits you, okay? But maybe if you were on another planet or, you know, in another reference grid, you would map it differently. Now, it's still the same principle that's acting, right? Universal. So, but you give it another reference grid to map it, to try to explain what it does. So here, if I was to take this grid, which we call the Cartesian grid, well, if you were to try to understand or try to map this line, which, you know, called the principle of gravitation for now, you would probably say that, okay, it's along with three, you know, the length and height would be a 3 over 2, right? So then in this one, you could say, okay, that's 1 here, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Would be 1 over 5. And then this one is 1 over 2. So, how can, you know, one thing be 1 over 5, 3 over 2, and 1 over 2? How can that be?
I guess it depends on how you look at it.
Well, yeah. Obviously, you want to be in the right reference. You want to have the best, in a sense, system of looking at it, or, you know, a reference grid, which is kind of like the most accurate with what reality is, although you might not see reality overall, you know.
Is that what Kepler means when he talks about paradoxes?
Paradoxes?
Like the different way you look at it, it appears different from a different side of looking at it.
Was that in the quote, or?
Well, he said, like, paradoxes would make you look into causes.
Oh, yeah.
And I think like this is like one, in one grid it's 3 over 2, and one grid it's 1 over 5, and one grid it's 1 to 2. So
yeah.
Like, yeah, that would get you like stimulated past.
Oh, yeah. Well, clearly, yeah, that's kind of like an irony, a paradox, yeah.
Because it's the same thing, but it's different on this
Yeah. I really try to make them as slow. But, yeah. So, I don't think it's a really good example, but I think it gives you somewhat of an idea of, you know, this idea of an invariant, but in a changing, you know, or multiply extended manifold, in a sense. That's not really like too extended, multiply extended. But when you get into the sphere, and I could have used some different shapes, but it gets kind of hard. And also, he says after the third degree, you know, you have the solid. But then, if you introduce another magnitude into this, then you're in the fourth degree, and you can't represent it as a solid. So there's a boundary also in geometry, which won't allow you to represent it. And you have these funny surfaces, the Riemannian surfaces. But really, I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling, because it's not really, it's not solid. It's a surface which interconnects and goes around and, crosses. Yeah, so it's like, you look at it, and you know that represents something that's kind of mind-boggling.
Am I clear so far, or is there questions about what we're doing?
Well, maybe just I'm trying to relate with the quote.
Yeah.
You read.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it seems that once you have these three things, where the same thing is, well, one thing is represented three different ways, depending on which, I guess, domain or world you're in. So the challenge would be to represent that reality in one single.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Thing,
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, right. I'll reread the quote because that's true. Yeah, it's to actually understand what these three are doing and just represent it in one. I'll just reread it, because, yeah, that's where we're going with that, actually. But a tensor is a type of quantity in which the dynamically connected relations within and among multiply extended manifolds are expressed as a unified magnitude. So you can express it. At a certain point, Riemann says, well, geometry is, kind of bounded at a certain point. So you can always express it in formula, but formula doesn't really give you, like, the idea of what, it's not a, you have to, in a sense, you have to take what you know about geometry and see what the formula, what's going on, and try to animate that, and the only place you can do it is in your mind.
Well, the cause can't be represented visually?
Well,
the tensor.
I mean, think about universal gravitation, and you have the planets moving around, and the only way you can actually do that, without looking outside, is actually to represent it in your mind. You look at what they're doing. You could have like datas and all that. Kepler had many data, but he didn't see the whole system at once. From outside the universe or outside the solar system, and say, hey, they're all going around the sun actually. No, he had to actually. He had to map it in his mind to see the whole process. So you can do it with one planet, that's easy.
you know, somewhat easy. But if you have six other planets, you know, you need something else to actually bring them, even though they're all many, you know, it's a many, but you want to bring it into a one. And that's what the tensor does. It actually give you an understanding of these processes as being one process.
So then
one action.
The one action or the one tensor is casting all these different shots.
Yeah.
Of reality.
Right. Question? Headache? Not so far? Okay, good. Let's keep going. All right. Okay, so Riemann is going to kind of give you an idea. Don't ask me any question about that. No. No, but we can't. I mean, it's just that I haven't really worked on that specific ideas. Right now, I want to give it to you because we're going to have to work on it, you know, in the next days and weeks, but I don't feel like I'm really an expert on that question. Who wants to read it? Ricardo?
The unlimitedness of space has therefore a greater certainty, theoretically, than any experience of external. For this, however, Carlo in no wise is infinitiveness. But on the contrary, space would necessarily be finite. If one assumes that bodies are independent of situation and so ascribe to space a constant measure of
curvature. Provide
this measure of curvature has any positive value, however small. If one were to prolong the element of directions that lie in any element or surface into shortest lines,
geodetics.
One would obtain an unlimited surface with constant positive measures of curvature. Consequently, a surface which would take on in a triplet extended manifold the form of a spherical surface and would therefore be infinite.
I put it there because I thought after doing these things it would kind of bring us back to Plato at this quote, you know, where he had this image of the weird solar system,
fire,
the earth and the earth, yeah, fire and air, yeah. But like this idea that actually maybe Plato was not too far from what's going on. But Riemann brings it, you know, with in a different way. And we're going to look a bit at what he means by curvature. He's talking about, you know, space and what is the curvature of space. It says it's, if it's positively expanded, if the curvature is expanded in a positive way, it would generate kind of a spherical kind of function, and so there would be a limit, there would be a boundary of that sort. So the universe would not be infinite, but the unlimitedness we're seeing, because we don't see the end of it, would be bounded. Which brings us to Einstein.
Just repeat that.
The universe would not be necessarily infinite, there would be a boundary of the universe, even though we don't see any limit.
So just because we don't see a limit doesn't mean it's limitless.
Yeah. And Einstein goes on, Lynn said he corrected Einstein on that one. I don't remember what the exact terms are. Like self-bounded, finite, self-bounded.
Finite, but self-bounded.
Yeah,
yeah, I think the idea of self-bounded,
yeah.
Bounded self.
So actually it was there in Riemann. They actually discussed that. So that's pretty, I mean, that's food for thought, that's for sure. Now we're gonna try to explain a bit of magic. You know, just so that you have at least a little understanding of that. And that won't be much more than me. So positive curvature, that's basically the example you just gave of this idea of the spherical shape. That's a negative curvature, and the flat would be like, you know, your usual Cartesian grid. Now that's very interesting, because it's also like Riemann breaks apart Euclid. But just showing that, you know, is axioms that basically from points you make lines, lines you make figures you make solids, and from there you build like a whole bunch of theorems, you know, postulates in these axioms. Well, you know, the idea that the sum of the, you know, angles, the interior angles of a triangle is equal to 180 degrees, that's only true in this one. If you're living in a Cartesian grid on the flat plane. Because here, the angles are going to be more. If you do the sum, it's going to be more than 180 degrees. And this one, it's going to be less. 180 degrees.
Wow.
Yeah. So only if the world is flat is Euclid right. Because the idea also of that theorem, of this idea, is that then from similar triangles it derives different, you know, theorems.
Yeah.
But if you don't have similar triangles, if triangles are actually never similar, because also it ties to this, the idea of the parallel postulate, that's actually, I was skipping a bit, but I should have read that first. I mean, the parallel postulate that two, you know, straight lines will never touch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what if you have a positive curvature like this? You could start perfectly straight, you know, at right angle here and here, and they'll touch. Well, actually, at the pole, but
wow.
So, if you just take that for it's given, you know, everybody knows the world is flat. Well, yeah, Euclid seems cool. Because he's got all these theorems, and he's got like a book full of them. But if the world is actually not flat, then we're in big trouble. Or Euclid is in big trouble, because that doesn't stand. You know, there's a problem here, there's a problem here.
What's the universe? Is the universe positive or negative? or both? Or how can it be both?
How can it be both? Yeah, that's a good question. Or is it? But that's, you know, the kind of that's something which is very useful to know, to work through Riemann, to have an understanding of what these curvature are in what universe you're going into. Because that's actually closer, that's an actual closer universe than this one. You'll never see that anywhere. Even though that's what we're using all the time in school. Okay. So, that being said, there's also this question of the mapping, which actually, that comes before Riemann, that's Gauss. But that's very useful because it's big. Well, the idea of being able to map, you know, something, kind of have a representation. Well, it's like myself and Matt were working with WDE on this question of creating an astrolabe, which is basically mapping the stars of the hemisphere onto a flat plane, which is, you know, pretty hard, or, you know, you need to understand curvature a lot, because the sky is not flat. So you try to make a map on a flat plane of something which is curved. Good luck. But then you need to study that. And I mean, Gauss did a lot of mapping, and he has a whole book on how, you know, to measure the curvature. But actually it was known back to the Egyptians. They already knew mapping of curvature.
Really?
Yeah.
Right,
because
they had,
yeah, and even before the Egyptians. You had astrolabes back then. And we had maritime cultures who were going around the world. So how did they direct themselves?
Yeah, you're right,
definitely. Yeah, only the stars, my friend. Figure it out, you're on your own. So they had to have a system, and we know that it's that one. They were able to map the stars onto a flat plane. Now that's, if you were able to see that animation, it's kind of funny, because the I can show it afterward, because it's basically when you have this circle onto the sphere moving, like let's say you were just you were taking one point on that string and you're pulling it to the pole, okay, what happens is that circle, which was mapping just mapping, you know, like a
projection.
Yeah, projection right down onto the plane. It actually becomes some exponential curve. And I think I'll show that to you later.
You mean like a curve, like exponential curve, like that?
Yeah, because you move the point here, it brings the whole thing. The string is going to move like that, and then this one breaks open. The one on the bottom breaks open, and does actually it moves around, or it could be moving under, depending of which direction you're going. It breaks and goes back on the other side. As this one on the other side is already moving like this.
Yeah. There's this really amazing video of that on YouTube.
Some
ways put together.
We'll see it later. But that's really interesting, because then you can map onto a sphere different objects. You can see what kind of like depending on the angle. Well, that's what he calls a normal, the white line, the radius, that's a normal onto your shape. And with the angle, you're going to be able to trace the shape, well, or understand what is the curvature of this shape onto the sphere, onto the surface of the sphere. So it's actually interesting because it's inversely, it has a funny relation. Because if you look here, when you have, let's say, so let's say that was the elliptical shape. So when you're on top here, the curvature of the ellipse is less. It's less curve on top here than on the side here, like an ellipse, you know?
Yeah.
So that's not really curved, but that's quite drastic.
Yeah.
Right? So here it's actually the inverse. The curvature is accentuated here and is getting kind of flat here. We can play with that a bit more. I just wanted to point it out. But it's fun to, you know, not just have me do it, but actually experience it. Do some experiments. Now, that's something else. If you were to map a torus, which is the donut shape here, onto a sphere, I mean, maybe that representation is not the best. There's a better one here. Yeah. So that's an animation which is on the website. And it shows you basically that when your normal is basically doing shaping, going around the sphere, okay, from the center, depicting like a spiral going up, it's going to do the same thing on the positive curvature, the outside curvature of the torus. Now, when you're on top and you decide, okay, well, we went up, now we're going to go back down. Well, the thing is that you have negative curvature in the torus.
What's a negative curve?
Well, it's the... It's this.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Right?
Spreading out.
So you're actually... Yeah, that would be... The inside of the torus would be here, underneath. Right? That would be like the inside.
Yeah.
So if you want to map it all onto the sphere, well, the sphere, it's just going to do the same thing, back down. But onto the torus, it's going to go on the inside. So you have positive curvature and you have negative curvature. What does it amount to? The sphere is positively curved. The curvature is positive for the sphere, you know? So it's positive.
So it sort of like cancels itself out on the sphere because you're like backtracking your steps.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sort of like undoing what you did. So you're sort of like canceling out the action, aren't you?
Well, not on the sphere, but on the torus.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No,
it's negative curvature inside. And it's positive outside. So the total curvature is actually zero.
Oh, right. So the amount of, at the end of the action, the amount of like curvature is balanced by negative curvature. So you have no, right?
Yeah.
Whereas it's always there's always positive curvature happening
on the sphere.
Okay, wait a second.
Right.
If I could just look at something.
Yeah.
You're saying if you were to spiral down like this,
mm-hmm.
eventually you get to the bottom and you touch the bottom and you start spiraling upwards like that. And then you get to the same point where you started.
Yeah.
And then you start outside again, type of thing.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's like you start from, you have your normal. It would just be easier to see on the website.
One sec.
Scale?
I'm fine.
You're all right.
Yeah.
That's British over there. There's also a water cusp by the...
You're all still alive?
Okay.
Yeah? Okay, good.
I'm spiraled in my head.
whoa. My head. I just can't stop it. Okay. Oh, that's going to be fun. Okay. All right. I'll start at the beginning. I'm just going to start back.
And that's at the website, the LIM website?
Yeah. It's on the WLYM. So if you have the normal, okay, one is in the center of the sphere, the other one is mapping the shape of the outside, right? So it's positively curved on the outside. And now when you're on top, now when you go down, you go back.
Oh, okay. So the,
you see it?
The upward action on the sphere is the outside of the torus.
Yeah.
The downward action. Negative.
Yeah, right. That helps. Yeah, it helps. Huh? Yeah.
So you go up, you're outside. When you go down, then you're negative, you're inside the torus.
Right.
Is that what, when you were talking about the universe is finite self-bounded, when you say like, is that like, could the universe be in that shape? The torus?
Well, I don't know if that's the best shape to be in. And if we're living in the best of all possible world, I don't know if I would have chosen a donut.
they're very tasty.
Well, I don't think so. Now, I'm not necessarily an expert on the universe, but I don't think that's the shape we're in. But who knows?
But it's like a
maybe we're gonna make a discovery about that.
it's a different manifold. It's like something to wrap your head around and maybe get a better idea.
Yeah, of what surrounds you, clearly. Yeah. Because then the idea is also like these processes which create these different shapes. You know, how do they? How does that work? How do you represent that? And you can, you know, mathematically, but physically. And then if you get to a higher level, if you introduce new magnitudes, you know, new principle that interact with what you already had, then you can't represent it just that way. So, yeah. So he calls it the simple transcendental, the sphere, the elliptical transcendental, so like the torus, and the hyper elliptical transcendental. That's another introduction of a new one there. So it's like a.
That's the name for the type of curvature?
Yeah. Hyper elliptical transcendental. What's the name for, I guess, the what generates that? And then the set of the curvature? But I guess, maybe. Because, okay, let's say, so we said here, so that was positive, so that's plus. Okay, let's say 1. That's actually 0 curvature. Let's see, outside is positive, and the inside is negative, so it's. At the end, you have 0 curvature,
mm-hmm.
And that one is -1.
Well, because the outside.
You know why? Yeah.
Well, my. What do you think?
Is that obvious? No.
I think
come right down. What do you think?
Because I see two toruses, and if a torus is 0, then you add another torus. can that be double zero? But just zero?
No, because it's negative curvature.
What's negative curvature?
Well, you have two negative curvature and one positive surrounding.
Oh, you don't have two positive, you have one positive.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, you have only one positive because that's continuous.
Oh, okay.
The continuity,
oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
All around is continuously positive, you know? You would be, you know, just riding on this, it'd be just fine. You'd be like, yeah.
Yeah,
but
cool.
When you get here, that's like, what?
Yeah.
And twice.
What do you call it, like a whirlpool type of thing?
Yeah. So there's two negative, you can call it also, these are like singularities in your, like if you were, maybe, like if you were thinking about you're creating that from a sphere, let's say, and yeah, it's like maybe you're playing with, you know, dough or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
And you shape it, and you create that kind of donut shape, and then you can do it, and you can twist it or, you know, play with it and create that shape.
Yeah.
But now you're with two singularities.
Yeah, that's like you made a donut, but you twisted it in half.
You could see it like that, yeah.
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 No, that's true.
Now don't twist the universe like that. Everybody was going to be sick.
Actually, that reminds me of something, but I'll show you later. It's,
okay. Yeah, I think I passed a quote I wanted to show you. Oh, yeah, here you go. So he's going to, now he's talking about the curvature and what Gauss did. These relations of measure can be investigated only in abstract notions of magnitude and can be exhibited connectedly only in formulae. Upon certain assumptions, however, one is able to resolve them into relations which are separately capable of being represented geometrically. And by this means, it becomes possible to express geometrically the result of the calculation. Therefore, if one is to reach solid ground, an abstract investigation in formula is indeed unavoidable, but its results will allow an exhibition in the clothing of geometry. For both parts, the foundations are contained in the celebrated treatise of Privy Councillor Gauss upon curved surfaces. So he says, like these tensors, or, you know, you can formulate them mathematically. If you were to try to dissect them, try to go back to, like, the elements that compose it, maybe not in all cases, but you could represent what, like, a particular action is in the whole. In a geometric way, you could construct, you know, a shape that would resemble the action or how it interacts for each of them, maybe. And then it would help you out, have some kind of a, you know, physical representation of it. Otherwise, it's a formula. But you know, it represents a physical action. Now, it's just not clear that you can always represent that geometrically. The tensor I don't know so much about that. I hope that the team is going to make new animations to explain a bit more. But we'll see what they've done so far pretty soon. That's again some food for thought. So here we are. Now the question of economics, right? Because now we've talked about formulas and geometry and stuff, and, you know, curvature. But Lynn says, well, that's all fine, but
it's more than that. Actually, tensors have to be used to understand economics. We need to be able to figure out the different elements, what are the processes that build the economy and represent it as a whole, as in a tensor, in a sense. Or that tensors would be representing what's going on in the economy. So not just one, but many. But as the concept which was developed first, in a sense, in the abiotic domain, but which has to be applied because it's actually a process which emanates from the human mind. Has to be applied to humanity also. That makes a lot of sense, you know. But that hasn't been really done until Vernadsky criticized Einstein on his use of tensors to represent, you know, in his relativity, his general relativity. And so he said, well, that's all fine for abiotic, but what about the biotic? How do we understand the processes that we actually live in? Not just the planets going around, you know, the stars, and space-time, but also our interaction with nature. So that's an example, actually. We have maybe this little video of how. Oh, is it that one? No, that's not one. I am. Wait a second.
Go to L pack. Merge pack. The other window is open.
Yeah, that's not what I want. Oh, I closed it. Sorry. I knew I did something wrong. Sorry. But the idea of, because that's the thing, at least I see it as, you know, you have certain boundaries, you place yourself in a certain universe, or how you conceptualize it, and now, well, actually when people make discoveries, they actually expand it. And one good example to show that is the creation of the Transcontinental Railroad in the United States. And we have this video that we produced here. There's no sound. It's just, it goes fairly fast, so if you try to read it, it's going to be hard. It's okay. Okay. So, think about that while you're seeing this. I mean, it started, you know, railroad were not too extensive during the 19th century at the beginning. But the human intention to actually bring about transportation, unify a nation. That's what we have to look at. When Matt was talking about this disease, actually, of imperialism, of trying to destroy nation, well, they can only do it when nation have built themselves, in a sense. So they can try to prevent the building of nations, of sovereign nations. And so this, LaRouche has pointed to, you know, the Transcontinental Railroad as an achievement which was finished after the Civil War, or really, I mean, in the sense of the First World War, finished like around 1869-70,
that was the point where the United States couldn't be attacked from within. They could only attack from without, sorry. But only from within. It couldn't be just you go and you send the troops in and you try to kill, pillage, loot, and destroy. But the United States was too strong to be attacked like that. The empire was, you know, had to change tactics. They wanted to destroy the United States. So that's actually interesting that a railroad made, you know, a nation invincible, in a sense, you know. How is a railroad, you know, it just tracks wood, metal, right? So there's something more to it. It's actually what it needed as a conception of mankind and of the progress of mankind, of where mankind was going, to have this idea. That was the real, in a sense, the most palpable thing to it. It's not just the tracks and the trains, and it's all, you know, it's there, it's done. That's not how you can calculate these things. Because at the same time, nowadays, the tracks are just, they're gone. Right? So, but that can indicate to you what is the process and what direction the society is going. And you can look at it and the, you know, think about this idea of unifying magnitudes. You can look at processes that in human life make life better. So that's one example. That's transportation. Now if you go back at the briefing, the healthcare system, that's something, you know, very useful. Even though we, you know, maybe a different type of infrastructure. You know, we could say transportation is kind of like a heavy-duty infrastructure, and education, healthcare, that, you know, not as heavy, maybe soft infrastructure, but totally necessary for a society to develop and to have a higher density of discoveries being made by each individual. So how do you actually, you know, put all these things together and calculate, you know, what's going on?
Yeah, it would totally drive somebody like Bertrand Russell like a radical positivist insane.
Mm-hmm.
You can't calculate that in any formula.
So, maybe not in one formula.
No, I know.
But, I mean, you know, when Lin developed his idea, I'm not going to go too much, you know, that's something that we should try to look at, you know, from that new standpoint of the tensors. But when you talk about, you know, relative population density, potential relative population density. And yeah, you can have different stages of humanity, you know, that are, your potential and what is actually there, your population that you can sustain.
Okay.
With, you know, and you're talking, every time we made a discovery, there's, you know, the standard of living, in a sense, the standard is made, you know, pushed higher and higher. So how many people can you sustain at a given technological level? You know, that's Yeah, that would make Bertrand Russell crazy. But that's the idea. You can, you know, behind that is the idea of how do you bring about these higher level of potential for your population to increase at always better standard of living.
Yeah, sure.
I think I know.
Think you know?
Gee. It has something to do with discovery.
Yeah, you think so?
Discoveries of ideas.
Yeah, makes sense. Well, that's why we're doing this work on the tensors. It's actually to investigate how the human mind makes discoveries. And not only that, but to be really conscious that you're making discoveries. And I think that's fairly important to be happy.
Yeah.
If I had to, you know, not make any discovery, I don't think there would be. I wouldn't be human. You know, that's really what, you know, the difference between human beings and beasts. But that's an example I wanted to show you in terms of physical economics. And, you know, you can think about other examples that we could represent and try to investigate how they affect human life, their standard of living, increase it, decrease it, in what way, how fast, you know, what's the rate, or what's the rate of the rate of change. And that's actually more important. So, these two guys, Einstein, Vernadsky, actually, I mentioned that before, but I put the picture up there.
Now we officially believe.
Now you see them.
We purely see them.
And you see the impact of these discoveries being made.
Or lack of discoveries.
Or lack. Or lack thereof. Right?
And darky is up.
Yeah. And that's also something that you can clearly see in human history.
It seems around the period of like Riemann and Vernadsky and those, then population really starts to shoot up.
Yeah.
Exponentially.
Well,
right.
You mean, lost the Renaissance?
It's, I mean,
no,
it's like
thinking
here.
Yeah, right.
I
haven't seen that.
Right.
Yeah.
Around the 1850s. Yeah, it's pretty steep.
But it makes sense with what you were saying about the railroads and things like that. Infrastructure projects and nation states.
Yeah, it's really only at that point that you could really have that kind of development happening all around the world since the American Revolution. So we could say that that's a principle that actually affected the whole, you know, that reshaped the boundary conditions.
Hey, with the Conic Sector. Oh, wow.
Whoa! Sorry. Oh, well.
No, keep going.
Yeah. So, now, Lin, in his last paper, also mentioned that the problem is when people, you know, become reductionist. They only see, like, problems on Earth and they, like, become cynical about it. Can't do anything about it. Unless we solve our problems here, can't, you know, think about doing anything else, you know, elsewhere. So we gotta fix that first. But the real thing is that it's a moral issue. It's gonna define if we are gonna survive or have a new dark age. And Lin said, well, we should fix our goal to Mars. And we could have done it already, but we were delayed. Since humanity was delayed into achieving that. But that's why at the end, maybe that everybody saw women on Mars, it's like, you know, it's not too long.
Yeah.
But I have it.
How long is it?
Half an hour. You can check half an hour.
Yeah.
So.
we can check it after. But I wanted to finish with the quote that Matthew paraphrased before. If you want to read it,
yes,
be great.
The most unfailing herald, companion, and follower of the awakening of a great people to a work of beneficial change in opinion or institution is poetry. At such periods, there is an accumulation of the power of communicating and perceiving intense and impassioned conceptions respecting man and nature. The persons in whom this power resides may often, as far as regards many portions of their nature, have little apparent correspondence with that spirit of good of which they are the ministers. But even whilst they deny and abjure, they are yet compelled to serve the power which is seated on the throne of their own soul. It is impossible to read the compositions of the most celebrated writers of the present day without being startled with the electrical life which burns within their words. They measure the circumference and sound the depths of human nature with a comprehensive and all-penetrating spirit. And they are themselves, perhaps, the most sincerely astonished at its manifestations. For it is less their spirit than the spirit of the age. Poets are the hierophants of an unapprehended inspiration, the mirrors of the gigantic shadows which futurity casts upon the present. The words which express what they understand not, the trumpets which sing to battle and feel not what they inspire, the influence which is moved not, but moves. Poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world.
So I think that's why Lynn says also that art, poetry, has to supersede mathematics and understanding as a higher domain where you can expand more your imagination in the world, in the physical world, instead of trying to map it in the formula. That art, irony, metaphors, actually the best tools to create an environment where humanity can develop.
True art, right?
True art, yeah. we're talking about classical. Classical art. Classical culture. And that's also a point that he made when he was in Italy just recently. He gave them a briefing about the situation here in the United States on the Obama healthcare reform. But he finished by telling them, well, look, the problem with you in Europe is that you're losing your classical culture. That's the worst thing that could happen. And it's by that, by inspiring people to actually rediscover what it is to be human, which just gonna break all the bonds that, you know, the Euro, the Maastricht Treaty and all these things did to Europe. It's gonna be, you know, that way that you're gonna be able to defeat oligarchism. So it's as important in Europe as it's important here in America. But yeah, these things, I just wanted to end with this picture of the dome in Florence, because that's, you know, that's really a proof that the universe is not flat. Because that dome, I mean, if you were to look at it Lin, when he was in Florence, said, well, that's the principle of the catenary, which is the hanging chain. What is the relationship between, you know, all points in a sense on the chain hanging? And it's not a parabola, it's not a mathematical shape, it's a physical shape. It was based, in a sense, the Brunelleschi, the man who made the dome, had to know that principle to make the dome. Now, the mathematical formula to express it was invented 2 centuries after the dome was finished.
So he built the dome with the principle, but not with the formula?
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's no skeleton inside of it. There's no structure inside of it holding this thing up. It's thoroughly just held up by its. It's
yeah.
Huge. It's
so he had to know the principle
right.
To build it, but the you know, principle is not formula. It's never like that.
Is that what Lin says when he says that mathematical formulae are shadows of the principle?
Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
The principle supersedes the formula.
Always proceed, yeah. So tomorrow we're working on Kepler. We're going to sing. You're all invited. We're going to continue this work. Hopefully finishing Kepler soon, then jumping into Gauss. And Rima is going to be for. We'll have time to work on that, give other classes. Or maybe invite people who are in the basement. That would be fun.